This episode is brought to you by Shopify. That's what I hear when I make another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform that allows you to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/podcast23, all lowercase, and take your business to the next level today.
This episode is brought to you by ITVX. Whatever it is you're looking for, from hard-hitting drama to side-splitting comedy, ITVX marks the spot. There's so much to discover, like the total comedy genius show Changing Ends, starring little old me, Alan Carr, or the groundbreaking new relationship show My Mum, Your Dad, hosted by Davina McCall. Stream free with ITVX, the UK's freshest streaming service.
You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network, the premier source for role-playing game entertainment. Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Network.
What is going on, Nation?
Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. It is Wednesday, December 6th, 2023, and I'm your old pal, Joey O'Brien.
And I'm Troy, switching my headphones live, LaValley.
Just happened, man. I went live, and you're not even in the seat.
Yeah, you know, I was like, shit, I don't want to wear my big over-the-ear headphones when I've got these cool, lightweight ones, but I already heard the music going. I'm like, this will be fun.
Yeah. Let's roll the dice. I don't know, man. I think that you might not make it as a news anchor in this town. You can't just drop off camera the second the show goes live.
This just in. I do what I want.
I'd love to see a news anchor do that sometime. Like, I'm hearing something from my producer. I do whatever I feel like.
This just in. Do whatever I feel like.
Troy, we have just returned, I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, from PAX Unplugged. 3 straight days of hot, sweaty gaming.
Yeah.
And it has dried out my throat. I don't have any con crud. I'm not sick, but I am dried out.
Well, it doesn't hit
out.
You the first day. You'll give it to a couple days afterwards, then you'll know.
Yeah, but what about you? You were like, on the last day, you got up and you were like, I'm 100% sick.
I just always feel sick this time of year. I treat my body like a truck stop toilet. I feel good. I feel good. I'm tired. Okay. I'm very, very tired. But yeah. That's because I was up late watching Hallmark movies.
Cons are exhausting, man. They're fun, but they are exhausting. It's so funny because we, from back in the day when we used to go, it would be impossible to not stay up all night partying and then game all day, you know. And I was so tired all day, every day at those cons back then. And now we're not staying up as late. We do have some more work stuff to do, but it doesn't change the feeling. I was talking to Paula Demi about this, who was there, that like when you're at the con, I just feel so freaking tired the whole time I'm there. And I'm trying to like push through. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's everybody at a con. You just constantly feel that way.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I could just feel great every day, all day. But I suppose I'd have to go to bed at 7:30.
Yeah, I don't know. This was a weird con and that like right when I walked in on Friday, because I went for a little bit before we had our call at the show, I was like, I feel like I've been to 50 of these this year. What am I doing? What am I doing here? Then after the show was done Friday night, we got to go back on Saturday and, you know, we had a lot of fun actually just playing a game for about 6 hours. And so that was nice. But I remember just being like, I'm ready to take a break now for the rest of the year.
Yeah. You know, and I also think that you are in a unique position in that people don't do what you get to do now, right? Like that you just get to fly to all these cons every year. Like the average consumer, which we used to be in this realm, was you went to the one that was close to you, right? Once a year. And it was like, yes, it's here.
Yeah.
And all that. And whereas like us, we're seeing a lot of stuff that was at Gen Con. right? So it's just kind of like making its way to the East Coast. And everything isn't so new and flashy, you know, at every single con. So it's kind of, yes, I feel like there was nothing that blew my mind on the floor, right?
Yeah, I don't know what I was looking for. I'm always walking around being like, oh, where is it? I have everything here. there's nothing here I don't have or could get with a phone call.
Yeah, Well, I brought my kids for the first time. That was awesome. It was really fun. I mean, they had an even shorter fuse than I did. You know, like after a few hours, you could do with the overstimulation. It was just like, you know, and you're like, all right, we got to walk away here for a little bit because you want to buy everything. You want to play everything.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes as a kid, you don't know how to manage those expectations. Right. But we had a great time. But it really did highlight for me. So last year and the years previous, I was there and I was like, man, there's so much stuff for kids here. I got to bring my kids. Then I get my kids there. And man, does it highlight for me how much adult stuff is there and how little stuff is really for kids. Because you're walking around and at one point my daughter was really frustrated. She was like, it's all just grown-up games, you know? And like, while you can teach, you know, a seven-year-old to play grown-up games, it's hard to walk up to a demo booth for like a 14 plus game and have them just understand what's happening, right? It's like, you see how many games are deeply complicated strategy games. And I was like, okay, all right, well, let's just go to the games library and get something that says 6 plus and we'll play that. And we did that and we had a great time. It was awesome.
Like on Saturday, we all played Root. You brought your copy of Root. You were really excited to find some nerds to play it with. And so me, you, and Kate and Sydney, eventually Matthew, played Root. And we had so much fun. And I was like, well, I mean, I would love to buy that. And it would just sit unopened in my closet because I couldn't teach this to my wife, my in-laws, nothing. You know, I got them playing Wingspan and we played a bunch this summer, like right after our Seattle trip, we went to a game store and you were like, oh, this is a great game, Wingspan. We played 9 games of that. And then we all went and bought it. And I'm like, this game, I couldn't teach to anyone.
No, for real. It is not for the uninitiated. I joked with a buddy that if I tried to teach one of my neighbors in town here to play it, they might never talk to me again. Or like invite me to another board game night. Because you'd be like, how dare you think that I would enjoy this?
I don't think we could teach it to Skid.
No, Skid sat there. I was so funny. Skid sat there. He watched. He asked for all the details as we were taking turns. He was engaged. He was like creating emergent story out of it like he always does. He was having a great time. And then Kate was like, I can't mentally play a second game. We're like, Skid, you want to jump in and play? And he was like, no. No, not at all. So, it was just so funny. He was like, no, this sounds miserable. Like, it was really complicated, but great. We loved it. We had a great time.
Yeah.
The show was awesome. The Philly show was great. Thanks, everybody who showed up there. It was way too hot in that room. Talking to McDermott in our morning meeting this morning, he said, what did he compare it to?
So infuriating, man. It's so
infuriating. He said that it was like, he's like, I guess the vibe the venue was going for was 12 angry men, like Louisiana courtroom in the 50s. Like that seemed to be the vibe.
Just it must so be a corporate policy because Chicago and St. Louis were hot, but like we mitigated it with fans and like telling them well in advance. And we asked them to cool it off this time and it was really cool backstage, but out there it's just uncomfortable, you know? Uncomfortable. Yeah. But beyond that,
they kept saying it's because they're part of a mall and they don't do the HVAC. The mall does the HVAC. It was like a whole thing, but that was a bummer. But otherwise, the show was great. Thanks everybody who persevered and hung out with us in that steamy VIP after party. We're going to hit a couple quick news bits here and then jump right into episode 11 GCP. Of course, we got We Are Stupid, lots of that, little remaster update, and then we'll get out of here on listener mail. So one of the news things that kind of dropped right at the show was the cast dice. The cast dice have dropped. This is something we mentioned in the GCP, if anybody, campaign two, if anybody picked up on that, but we have negotiated with our sponsor Norse Foundry to create individual dice for every performer. Once again, this time though, new campaign 2 dice, individual gem dice for each player with their own unique custom crafted wood box that has their own engraving on it. You got one there?
Yeah, I got mine. So this is what happened. We had Angeline, who does all the art for our tour, create unique individual designs for each of the boxes. So there's a Kate box, a Joe box, Skid box. And in order to get each person's dice set, it's only linked to the box. You can't get a Kate box with Skid dice. Can't do it. So everything is like down to the wire. And our buddies in North Foundry are like, we got them. They're ready to go. And we open them all up like at 3 o'clock the day of the show, and it's everything except Troy and Joe Dice. So we're like, it just like fell off a UPS truck.
Lost in shipping, yeah.
Yeah, so the Skid and Matthew and Kate and Sydney dice were on sale at the show. The rest will be putting up soon somewhere.
So keep an eye on the store, yeah.
And the Joe and Troy dice will be coming. But we have the Joe and Troy boxes. So this is the Troy box. You can see, I don't know how I can do there. It's kind of like a beer bottle with some Christmas. I got to do like I'm teaching a karate class with the opposite hand. It's like a beer bottle with some Christmassy cocktail-y things, and the water's coming out, and a D20 is rolling out of it. They're all really, really unique.
It's a very cool design, yeah.
And everyone sort of contributed to the design idea, and then Angeline just did their magic.
Yep. So look for that. Keep an eye out on this store. They should be coming up soon. So keep an eye out on the web store for those to drop. One more thing before we go into the episode. I just want to give you guys a save the date, Nish. I want you to save the date if you are a fan of Blood of the Wild. Blood of the Wild is going to have a little Christmas party, a little Kaz Christmas party, because we can't be together. So we're going to get together live between Christmas and New Year's. Save the date, Friday, December 29th. Friday, December 29th, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. We're actually going to go live on our Twitch channel and just hang out. So we're just going to talk. We're going to talk about this first year of Blood of the Wild, and we'd love to interact live with you guys. So if you're listening to Blood of the Wild, make sure you get caught up and listen all the way up through that week of Christmas. And then on December 29th, we're all going to hang out live. So save the date. More details to follow on that. Let's talk about the Glass Cannon Podcast, Campaign 2, Episode 11. I really enjoyed this ep. I mean, it always seems weird for us to talk about our own episodes. But here's the thing. Cannon Fodder was born originally out of this idea of, we do this anyway. We would always like hash out episodes after the fact, say what we liked, say what we didn't. And I really liked how this combat developed, how it was set up. And I think there was a lot of really fun energy and comedy between the players as we were getting into it, just making fun of each other. And you can tell that everybody is really starting to sink in to working with each other, right, mm-hmm. in this show, because there's a lot of like, oh, Sydney always does this and Kate always does this. And so it takes a long time to develop those kind of habits where you can understand how people play and then poke fun, you know, when the situation presents itself. This episode, I thought, showcased that a lot. Let's talk about the encounter to start, which is a dream spider over top of this room that we're in with another Oak Steward. And we begin by seeing this ladder being pulled up out of the room. Talk to me about the opening of that encounter. I want some behind the scenes knowledge here, and don't BS me. Just give me the straight juice. Like, is this encounter designed to start in this way? Is there a way that you can surprise them and they don't pull the ladder up, or did they hear us? Did they make rolls? How is this encounter supposed to start, and how did it, if it was different, what changed in our playthrough?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the exact thing that happened, like the core. I don't know if I had you all roll perception or if I was doing secret perceptions. I can't remember what I did. I think I end up doing secret perceptions for all of you, basically. Now, where there's no surprise rounds anymore as written, I just wanted to see whether or not anyone would notice this happening, the ladder mm-hmm. being pulled up. Because as written, it kind of like baits you into the room. Or like waits till you're exploring the room and starts to pull the ladder up. But I figured,
so that's in it. That's part of it. That was a cool encounter design. Like, the first thing you see is a ladder being pulled up.
Right.
What do you do?
What's going on up there? Right.
Yeah.
And so, especially where they both have ranged abilities, it would have made it really tough if that ladder got up there. But I'm thinking, like, that's going to make noise. I think maybe in the past, and I'm sure people would run it this way, it's just like, you notice the ladder gets pulled up, roll for initiative. Mm-hmm. But this was like, I'm starting to pull the ladder up, and I think Lucky and maybe Zephyr heard or succeeded on the perception check. I can't remember what it was. And so now it's down to initiative. If I roll a higher initiative, that ladder's going up. That's right. It. Game over. But how much more interesting is it? And it just kind of worked out this way that Lucky's like, I run and jump on the ladder. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. So this is what it's going to be. It was great. It was a great little discovery in that moment. And then, of course, it's still kind of a tug of war until Zephyr jumps on. And then that's enough weight to pull it down. And he just
and it was very interesting because Zephyr is in a position where she is like, and this is something that I've dealt with as a ranger in the past. She's a monk, but like, Lork was kind of a switch hitter ranger, they called him in first edition, which was could competently use a bow, could competently use a melee weapon. And when you get into these like dungeon crawly kind of things where it's all these small rooms, your bow gets harder and harder to use. And in 2E, the volley trait has really it really encourages you to not use a longbow in a 15-foot by 20-foot room. Like,
right.
They're just like, this isn't a feasible thing. So Zephyr had stowed the bow, contrary to how she had originally started this whole dungeon crawl. Mm-hmm. And those free hands are actually what allowed her to jump on the ladder in one action, grab it, and pull it down. So I thought that that was cool.
Yeah.
And she didn't have to leave her bow behind. It was just already kind of strapped to her back. But all right, so let's talk. I'm going to do something here. I don't even know. I just realized this might be a problem. But you know what? I'm committed, and I'm doing it.
Committed to the bit.
You're just going to have to deal with it. I'm committed to the bit. I want to go on Demiplane and show you a Dream Spider because I found it on Demiplane. And let's just look at some of these stats here.
Cool looking spider.
It's a very cool looking spider. Where does it come from? Do you know? Did it say in the book? Was it from the book or was it like a...
Yeah, but that's information you don't have yet.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. Well, yeah. I just meant the Dream Spider like design.
Where they like generally book? Come from.
What, you know, was it... Because I remember Dream Spiders in... whatchamacallit? Emerald Spire. They were in Emerald Spire. So they've been around. Small animal. Just looking at some of its stats here.
I'm reading here. To see if there's something I can tell you. Yeah, no, you're still trying to figure out how this came to be. But in terms of like the etymology of the Dream Spider, just keep scanning on there. You'll see.
A Dream Spider's webs have iridescent blue hues and are infused with the same hallucinogenic compound as the creature's toxin. So this toxin, what it was doing to us was immobilizing. No, that was the web. Oh, it was making us stupefied.
Yeah,
it made you stupefied in that first round, and we can actually put that up. Right. So yeah, it's the Dream Spider venom.
Yeah, you just jumped out there. It says the Shiver Addicts. Like that's where Shiver is made from their venom.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. What a cool inset.
Yeah, talented alchemist processed Dream Spider venom into an addictive drug called Shiver. Now the difference with Shiver is you start out being like courageous before you start tripping and pass out.
Right. But oh, that's
this one
cool.
Here, you just get stupid, and then you start taking poison damage. Yeah, it can be pretty nasty.
I've definitely heard of Shiver, but I didn't realize it was developed from Dream Spider venom. That's awesome.
Yeah, I feel like you ran a PFS for us a long time ago where we were like stopping a Shiver operation. I remember that, or maybe that was from Curse of the Crimson Throne. There was something where
maybe it was.
There were these guys that were pushing Shiver. I mean, that's how I know it.
Yeah. But it just really surprised me because anything that hasn't been an Oak Steward has been Fae, right? Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden there's this Dream Spider and it seems almost like a companion or something, like a druid animal companion. I really don't know what the deal is. Definitely want to find out more about it, but it was I really enjoyed the different levels of the encounter, being downstairs from a spider that is shooting webs down at you and immobilizing you while there's an Oak Steward up there just leisurely casting Shillelagh. It was a very intimidating situation. And then Zephyr getting stuck on the ladder created good things, maybe, yeah. Ranged cover, bad things. We couldn't get up there, right?
Yeah, it was tricky. This is what Foundry does so well, is like having the multiple levels. Like when Lucky went up there and I could switch to a new map that only Lucky could see.
Yeah.
And then it became this like two on one fight, and then we go back downstairs. You guys have no idea what's going on, but Lucky can see everything. It was just really fun, like having different levels. It's also a testament to how cool this map layout is for this first part of the adventure. Like, there's just a lot of doors and levels and bridges where you can see other parts of the building, but not inside the rooms. And
yeah. It's really, really cool design. We've said it a couple times already in show at this point, how cool the level design is here. And it really does show in this one where you just have like a hole in the ceiling, right? Yeah. And the only way to get through it is the ladder. All right. Well, let's get into this, because with all the combat, there was indeed some notes from Professor Eric on sure. things we did right, things we did wrong, and some interesting things to discuss. So I'm gonna jump into We Are Stupid here with... I'm going to come right at you, I think.
Oh boy.
Excuse me.
I'm ready.
I'm going to come right at you, dude.
I got my dukes up.
So you, as the Oak Steward, went ahead as Zephyr came up the ladder and you threw an acid flask. And man, I was cracking up. I mean, this was so classic Glass Cannon. Like, you were like, I throw it right in your mouth. And it just evoked such a horrible image. Like, bam, I pour it right in your face. And Professor Eric brought up that the acid flask itself is actually 1 point of damage. You said 6 points of damage, but it's actually 1 point of damage and 1d6 persistent. So that wouldn't have happened at that time. That ticks later. Here's an acid flask on Demiplane. I'm assuming it was a lesser, but it deals one acid damage. And then the persistent acid damage and listed splash damage.
So I said 6 damage right out the gate because
you rolled a d6.
Okay.
And you said 6 damage.
Oh, that's so weird. I wonder why I did that.
And then, if memory serves, so you were unfair to Zephyr there. And then I think, not 100% sure.
I'm bringing up Foundry to see why I screwed this up. Because, you know, since this recording, I've dealt with a lot of alchemists. I've been playing alchemists on Strange Aeons and alchemists, or I don't know if I've done more on this, but I've been reading a lot of like lesser acid flasks, moderate flasks, greater flasks, and seeing like how they work. So seeing that I made that mistake surprises me because now I've spent so much time with it. But I'm also just trying to figure out how I fucked that up in the moment. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I definitely know that's how that works.
Yeah.
Like all of them are different. The alchemist fire does one thing. The lightning yes. does one thing. And there's as properties that are like hidden. You have to, when you read on the page, like the lesser acid flask or the moderate acid flask will tell you what it does, but also all acid flasks do X. And so you kind of have to make crib notes for yourself. I'm just trying to figure out how I fucked this up.
Yeah, it's like you said, having a shorthand of notes is going to be very helpful. But the one positive thing that so like it's a little bit negative that you do that damage technically too early. But then I think that you didn't mention it on Zephyr's next turn, right? So I don't know if you forget that there's this persistent damage, but like, you know, we have to forget or remember
the wash.
that's out there. Yeah, exactly. It comes out in the wash. So we're all good. Matthew did a treat wounds. This goes back to just before the combat. And he mentioned he doubled his 2d8. And I told him on air that it's 4d8. The difference there, and Professor Eric points it out, it's like, it's fine. You guys caught it on air. But just remember, once your medicine levels up and you are doing 2d8 plus 10, like you do not double. You just do 4d8 plus 10 on a crit. You don't double the 10, you know, so it's it does not get doubled. So it's just important not to get in the habit of doubling, but doing double dice.
I see why I did that. It's Foundry says 1d6 plus 1 acid as damage.
Really?
Yeah. And it's like acid flask, strike plus 5, and then 1d6 plus 1 acid.
Was so it a moderate flask or something?
No, it's a lesser acid flask. It just that's how it was written here. It's up to me to know that's not how acid flasks work. But as written, it looks just like staff, strike plus 6, 1d4 plus 2 bludgeoning. It looks exactly the same. Ranged, acid flask lesser, 1d6 plus 1 acid.
Oh, so it's just like a typo, basically. Like
Because when I look at the actual book, it just says lesser acid flask. But it says damage 1d6 acid plus 1 acid splash right in the John.
Weird.
Yeah, so it's, I think it, I think it's
a you think you caught a mistake on Foundry?
I mean, the way acid flasks are written in the handbook is different from how it's written both in the adventure and on Foundry. Hmm. So it could be that like they just wanted this to be different or
maybe they were possible. More potent acid flasks. But here's why I think that that's wrong. Let's go back to let's look at a moderate, right? Like if it was a moderate, you go to a moderate here and it's still only one acid damage. And what goes up is the persistent. And I think that this is very interesting narratively. It's like acid, when it hits, doesn't hurt right away.
Yeah.
But it just starts seeping in and then it can be really, really terrifying and damaging. So as it levels up, it still is only doing more persistent damage, not more initial damage.
Yeah. No, it's always one damage and then yeah. It's more splash and more persistent. Yeah. But yeah, we may have caught a little error. Ooh. Or maybe they just wanted to call it something else. Like call it an acid envelope.
Spider pee.
Right, spider pee.
flask. Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad we squared that away. That's good. I'm glad that you stayed persistent with it, too. You were like, I know I didn't make a mistake. I'm not stupid. You're stupid.
You're stupid. The book's stupid. We're all stupid.
Okay, let's do this. All right, so this was a big chunky one that we kind of debated in the episode. If you recall, it was, when do you make your save for poisons?
Yes.
When do the rounds tick, right? On the creature's turn, on the afflicted character's turn.
Beginning of the turn, end of the turn.
Beginning of the turn, end of the turn, exactly. So, there is no answer. There's no straight answer. Professor Eric lays out that it is vague and that different GMs handle it differently. There are a lot of GMs who handle it as persistent damage to make it easier. It occurs on the afflicted creature's turn. At the end of their turn. The downside of that is that you can have the first two saves of that poison be a little bit too close together, right? So if it's like you do the first save and then you're the next character to act, what you have to do that again, right? Like,
it should tick on the creature's turn because then a whole round goes.
Exactly. So what Professor Eric does is he does it on the creature's turn that executed the poison, but he does it at the end of their turn. He always does it at the end of their turn. He's like, it's just to make it easier to remember because most things that tick in across the game happen at the end of turns. So he's like, I just do it at the end to make it easier. I also like, he's like, you definitely don't want to get into the weeds of like, well, it did it on its second action. So does it tick during its second action of the next turn? Right. It's like, just do it at the end of the turn, or you could do it at the beginning as long as
you maintain consistency. I think you should do it at the beginning because, the problem is if you're then exposed to that again, it increases the stage. Mm-hmm. So like it's that definitely favors the enemy if you're waiting till the end of the turn, because like, let's say someone gets hit, fails, goes to stage one, right? If you now comes back to the creature, if you don't do the save again at the beginning of the turn and that creature bites you again, hits you, you have to then roll again right away because you've been exposed to the poison again. You could be taken to stage two. And now you make your save at the end of it, the creature's turn, and it brings you back to stage one when you should have been cured. Whereas if you do it at the beginning of the turn, let's say you fell to stage one and then before the creature goes, roll your save. You're cured. And now you get attacked again and you get exposed to the poison and fail. You go back to stage one. So it definitely favors the enemy to wait to the end of the turn. But I think the spirit of the game wants you to do it at the beginning of the infecting creature's turn.
Yeah, the main reason he says he does it at the end is because it's just easier to remember.
Sure.
Like when it gets to the creature's turn, you sort of do, you're thinking as a GM, like you have so much in your head and it's just like, all right, let me execute this creature's actions. Then at the end of its turn, what's the cleanup, right?
Yeah.
Like what are the cleanup steps?
Sure.
That's the only reason. So yeah, if you remember to do it at the start of the turn, then yeah, I see no reason why it shouldn't be that way as long as it's maintained in that consistency. Okay. Yeah. And so that's it on that. I think that's a good thing for us to try to remember is tick afflictions on the start of the creature's turn. The other reason he said, this is a good point, that GMs do it on the character's turn. The one positive of that, doing it on the afflicted character's turn, is that you as the GM do not have to continue to track a dead creature's initiative for the ticking of the poison.
Yeah. Right.
right? So that can get you in the weeds a little bit. If you're like, all right, I want to get this off my initiative board. This creature's dead. Like, remember, you can't do that. Like, you have to, that creature's initiative matters.
I wonder if there's just a buried rule that we're all missing. It's like, it seems strange they wouldn't have outlined something that's very, very important.
It's funny. I don't think that's weird at all because we have these discussions every week.
Do we?
On the vagueness of the rules. Yeah.
That seems like an oversight to me, not like a, you do what you want. Like this is like all three of those options that we've given, beginning of a character's turn, end of a character's turn, beginning of an ending, all have like wild swings in like the difference of how things affect.
We'll play out.
Yeah. Maybe the remaster has.
Hey. Comment on the YouTube video.
Yeah, let us know.
If you know an answer that we're missing, yeah, please write it on the YouTube video. We'll find it. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about disarm for a second. So, you know, Lucky wants to disarm this creature. And this just creates a bit of a shit show, which I love. I
read something so funny about this, and like, I don't know if you're going to bring it up. So just remember, if you don't, I'll bring it up.
Okay.
It's just like a Sydney thing that I don't blame her for. It's just like so shitty. I'll just say it, that like the thing says that it's used to disarm, but the weapon doesn't even have the disarm trait, so she can't use it.
Yes, this is exactly what I was going to. Well, one of the things I was going to say was, and it's so funny you mentioned that because I was going to say exactly that. I was going to say exactly that I don't blame Sydney.
Yeah, so no, like, I know.
If you go to the Kopesh here on Demiplane, it's like, this curved sickle sword has a pointed tip allowing it to be swung like a hand axe or thrust like a short sword. The tip of the Kopesh is usually hooked so it can be used to disarm an opponent's shield or weapon.
That's a real oversight.
And yet, you can't use it to disarm an opponent's shield or weapon. What it does have is the trip trait. For whatever reason, you could use this weapon to trip with the athletic skill. Anyway, it seems like an oversight for sure. It's certainly not.
It's definitely
Sydney's
an oversight.
Fault. Yeah, exactly. The weapon traits right here, trip. It would have to have the disarm trait to allow you to use it to disarm.
So
now,
funny.
You could, I believe, technically use it to disarm, but you would have to have a free hand. And as a two weapon fighter, she doesn't really have that. So she really needed a weapon with the disarm trait. Couple other things during this encounter. And this is where we'll bring up the remaster, because if you recall, one of the things that I complained about was, and we dealt with this in the was this Strange Aeons? Yeah, it was Strange Aeons, right? Where we were dealing with the disarm in like the god scenario.
Sorry, I'm looking at this ego. I'm like, this got to be something wrong with this. So the disarm the disarm action, you have at least one, the requirements are you have at least one hand free. The target can't be more than one size larger than you. Anyone can do that.
Yeah.
The only thing the disarm trait gives you is that you don't have to have that hand free.
Right.
So I don't think it's an oversight. It's just a weapon that can be used to disarm. You got to do it. You know, you got to have a free hit if you want to do it.
I think that it is absolutely an oversight.
I don't think so.
Why would you write the tip of the Kopesh is usually hooked so it can be used to disarm an opponent's weapon or shield and not have it have the disarm trait?
Because the disarm trait just allows you to do it without even if you don't have a free hand.
So then why don't you write you can disarm an opponent with a short sword? In every short sword, like, description.
It's just like, this one's really good for it.
It doesn't
have the trait.
It has no different. It's no different than a dagger, right? Like,
yeah.
In terms of mechanically how it works.
Maybe
with disarm.
Most people don't have a Kopesh and another something else in the other hand. They're just like, because they know, like, this thing is really good at disarming.
But it isn't. It has no mechanical benefit to disarming.
It is strange. It is strange.
It's very
strange. Want to make sure we made that clear. Like, you can still disarm without a weapon having the disarm trait.
I said that. While you were reading. I said that. And it's just that, like, but her being a two-weapon fighter, that's what makes it funky, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you just did it with, if you used the Kopesh one-handed, you could disarm just fine.
What if you threw one weapon up into the air and it's like spinning.
And while you.
Second action to this third action, grab the weapon.
I'm going to suggest that she do that with Lucky at some point, because
that's pretty fucking cool.
If she asked and you were like, yeah, use one extra action to do it. That sounds dope.
That's pretty badass.
It's pretty.
It's like,
and it lands right back
Creed
in.
Shit, yeah.
And then she kicks the weapon away because she just crit. Because speaking of which, you have to crit to disarm the weapon. And this is what drives me nuts. Now, yeah. I agree, completely agree, that just rolling a successful athletics check would be overpowered to just knock a weapon out of somebody's hand. I mean, it would just be encounter breaking, right? I get that. The way that the disarm originally worked was that it gave the creature a a minus two circumstance penalty to attacks or other checks to grasp the item, and you a plus two circumstance bonus to on further disarm checks until the start of the creature's next turn. And it was like, until the start of the creature's next turn. So that means you have to have the extra actions to try to disarm again, which, by the way, I believe has the attack trait. So, right, you're taking the map on that. Mm-hmm. Or you have to have an ally lined up to follow up your disarm with a disarm right away. And that person still has to crit before you're going to actually knock that weapon out. So it makes it kind of like, ugh, you know, why are we even going to try? Well, one update to the remaster, which makes things a little bit more interesting. It's not completely like swung the other way, but they added a very important line. The creature can end the effect by interacting to change its grip on the weapon. The penalty lasts as long as the creature holds the item. So like it doesn't reset at the start of the creature's next turn. They have that minus two circumstance bonus to all attempts to disarm until they spend an action to right the weapon. So that's a little bit better. It forces the creature to have to waste an action or be at risk of having it disarmed, even if it's after its next turn. So that's an interesting tweak that they made to disarm.
I like that they made it so that you've really got to, like, let's all try to disarm and make it so that 19 people have to gang up, because disarming sucks. It sucks. Like, it was so easy in Giant Slayer for, like, Baron to just boom, shoot a sword.
Well, yeah, that was a gunslinger thing. Yeah. That was just preposterous.
I like, let's make it as hard as possible to disarm, and I'm fine with that. And then the thing that I think that in the moment we were overlooking is that minus two. That's huge. That's huge. So much more in this game.
No, we said we didn't overlook it. You said it. But the problem is it ends at the start of the creature's next turn.
Yeah.
So the only way it would take the minus two to attack is on an AOO, if it had an AOO.
Right? It has to be timed right. Like, you're doing it before the monster attacks and before your friends can admit that. You've got to really know the rounds and know when to do something like that, when it's even worth doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't see it working before the remaster. It doesn't work. Like, you know, in terms of the attack penalty. Like, the attack penalty, it goes away at the start of the creature's next turn. So it's never going to take the attack penalty. But now, with the remaster, it has to spend an action to write the item and get rid of that penalty.
Yeah, that is kind of lame.
Yeah, but it's been improved, and I'm happy with the improvement.
Okay, cool.
Also, a note, the Kopesh, the Kopesh is not agile. I believe we... Oh, she said it. Sydney said it was agile. I think she was thinking of her other weapon. So we gave her a minus four on her AOO, or no, not the AOO, the second attack that she did. And I think she still hit or whatever, but it was just like, it should have been a minus five. Little tiny thing, but got to have Sid remember that weapon, though it sounds like an agile weapon and cool, does not actually have the agile trait.
Agile trait.
All right. And then last thing before we get to listener mail is just this, is climbing the ladder. By the book, you have to have two hands free to climb. There is a feat, Combat Climber, that reduces you to only needing one hand. I play with every player I play with just thinks that they can always do everything with one hand when they have a weapon in their other hand. And I get very like, no, things are complicated. Climbing is a complicated thing, whatever. So he points it out here, Professor Eric, that you do have to use two hands. And so the whole like lucky leap up the ladder, get into the room, attack twice with a weapon. He was just going cross-eyed, I think. I think Professor Eric was like, how on earth are you making this happen? Like, you got to get up there. You have to interact to draw the weapon. Maybe you get one attack in. You certainly don't get two. So that's just something important for us to remember. Two free hands to climb.
She needed to, one action, stow one weapon. Second action, stow another
weapon.
Exactly. Or really free action, drop a weapon. Be like, I'm just going to be one weapon from now.
Yeah.
Climb, get up there, another action to, And the thing is, that's one of those things that as a GM, you're like, this doesn't seem like something they're interested in doing.
And, It's true.
You got to kind of pick your battles. I want everybody to police themselves, but it also, like, I think the alternative is she doesn't go up there because she's like, that's too much. That's hamstringing me too much. There's no sense in going up there, and it ended up leading to a more exciting combat. So it's just this really tough thing to try and balance with, like, you know, staying true to the rules and like trying to do things that make the combat more interesting. I don't really have an answer for it. Like, I wish my ideal answer is like, do it the right way and still go up there. Like, be bold. Maybe I'll get a hero point out of it. But Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough. I feel like this line that we're always walking with 2E, with any game this tactical, with rule books this dense, with movement and interact rules that are this complicated, you have this worry and concern of it constantly stripping away fun ideas, right? It being like, oh, it's grinding. But what I think is people have to stop thinking that you just do whatever you want in your round narratively and start thinking of the actual complications that come with these things in a physical universe with rules and then make that narrative, you know, because that is really interesting to me. People be like, oh, it's so much less interesting. She couldn't even get up there then that round. It's like, well, make it interesting. You know, it's like, I sheathe my weapons and I start climbing up. That's my round. It takes 3 seconds. You know, it gives the enemy an advantage. Things are tense, you know, like it, instead of complaining about how many actions it took you and dragging everything to a halt, it's like just go with the narrative element that the rules put you into, and it feels more realistic and fun in the way that it gave you a – it's not even a disadvantage. It's just, you know, it takes you one more round to get up there. What's the big deal? You know, a couple more pot shots. Oh, you get stuck. Well, then it creates even a better show, right? Like if now two of them are immobilized, how are we ever going to get to these people? It just creates better drama. And then when the heroics come out, they're that much bigger. So anyway, that's my 2 cents on it.
We've always talked about this before. It's like, make the game harder on yourself and not like, just for the sake of being harder on yourself, but like assume that everything is more difficult to do than you assume, you know, like climbing. Yeah. It makes sense. You're like, I'm holding, I can open a door with something in my hand. I can do that. Be like, okay, well, maybe you can't. And then, so how do you work within those constraints? And it's tricky. You know, some people just
How about this? How about like a 12-foot ladder, right? Up the side of your house and a can of paint in one of your hands, right? We've done that. You got to do it. You hold on. Do you think you could do that while people are shooting shit at you? Right? Like in the harried hecticness of combat, do you think that you'd have a good grip on that ladder and would fly up there at full speed? You know what I mean? Like even I have to go half speed when I'm holding something and I'm not having arrows shot at me. So I do think that this is an interesting, like that's why there's a feat and it's called combat climber. You know what I mean? It's like, you know how to climb in combat. So that means you can do it with one hand. You can do it easily. And then, I believe Professor Eric believes that catfolk get a climb speed at 5th level.
So that's cool.
Yeah, at 5th level, this all becomes easier for you, okay? But early on, we got to grind it out. Anyway, I just think that thanks for pointing that out, Eric, and I just think that that's one of those interesting things, because I think we all at times find ourselves being like, and you've done this, I know, been like, God, like you just see it and you're like, I'm one action shy in the economy, and it throws the whole round off for you. And like, I get it. I get that frustration. I've been there. Try to just, instead of changing the whole strategy and grinding everything down to a halt to make the perfect turn, like just do a little bit less that round and then save it up for next round where you can. So.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, fun times. Let's do a little listener mail and then we'll get on the road.
It's time for listener mail. Gotta get your brush up on it. Time for listener mail. You gotta cue that fucking
Thank you so much, Nicholas. All right, this one from Andrew in Minnesota. What's up, Andrew? Thanks for writing in. This one, I had to throw this out there because as you, Troy, are now getting deeper and deeper into recording season 2 of Time for Chaos, I thought this one was appropriate. How much should my players be responsible for remembering in a long-term campaign? We play once a month for about a 5-hour session. I send emails of recaps to recap sessions. I have a Google Drive sheet with all the recaps. I do a last time recap before we start each session, and all I get are blank stares and crickets. Do I need to not play with stoners, or do you have any tips? It's a great question, Andrew.
Great question.
I certainly don't have an answer to that age-old problem for GMs. I think we all suffer from it to a certain extent. I just wanted to tell Andrew, I feel you. I commiserate. It is, in Delta Green, it's the same thing. And I feel like players are good about focusing on their characters and their characters' emotions and their characters' development and their interaction with the other characters. They're doing a lot of work there, and that's important. And that will give lifeblood to a story that you're telling. Not necessarily the clues. The clues aren't the lifeblood of a game. It's really the players' interactions with each other. And as long as they care about their characters and want that to shine, you're going to be okay. But I'm just amazed at, like, when I put clues on a board, on our VTT and just let people, they're there the whole season. You can look, you can re-look, you can talk about you, and no one ever looks at anything. Nobody cares. It's just it's amazing to me. What are your thoughts as you head into it, as you get started on this next season of Time for Chaos? How much actual recapping did you do behind the scenes with the players?
None. I did no recapping. I had a big recap for the season two premiere, which will be out eventually. So I did a big recap.
Did it get, like, on air? Yeah,
on air. And, like, I have the added benefit of Michael, who works with us, is backstage for every recording and, like, is writing recaps of the stuff that goes out to the players. Or he'll send it to me afterwards, and then I'll, like, add a couple things, rewrite it a little bit, and I'll send it to the players after each session just to remind everybody, oh, you took this. I mean, it's great. Michael, like, will be like, you took this much sanity. You were indefinitely insane, or this,
wow,
or that.
Wow, wow.
Here's some important things that you learned, and some books that you found. Here are the names of those books and everything. And so it's great. It's actually very helpful for me. Even as I was preparing for season two, I would go back and look at, like, old recaps and be like, hey, who found that book? Who started reading that tome? So it's super helpful. And, like, when I look at the VTT that we have for Time for Chaos, there's so much shit there. I mean, in episode, like, six, once they got to New York, it was just like a dump of 12 news articles. And I always think, like, anybody ever go back and read those? There's a lot of stuff in there. But then it's not like I'm sitting there pouring over the Get in the Truck one, so I have to practice what I preach.
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's a lot of information. I just came to the realization a long time ago that everyone engages in games in different ways. And mm-hmm. some people are really into, being on top of their studying, and other people just want to play games and I forgot about that. And I think that, like, I've kind of fallen into that as a player, because I don't play anymore. Like, I there's a part of me that always wishes I could start over again at, like, a first level character and really, like first day of school, I show up with my pencils sharpened and I'm all right, I'm taking excellent notes, but, like, stick with it. And I don't, and it sucks. So I can't ask the other players to do that as well, but it is frustrating. That's why I've also gotten used to just, like, when I throw something out there and see, like, stone face reaction, give it a moment and then be like, now, if you remember, you spoke to someone, because it's like, I'm not going to just not, like, punish you because you don't know how important this information is.
That was going to be my next point. It's like, yeah, and I think you said it even better, because you took it to a higher level of gaming in general, which is a very important note. People don't all play games the way you do or the way you want to, meaning you, the royal, you, all GMs out there, the way we approach it. People don't care about the same things necessarily that you care about, and you're in the business of catering to your players in some way. Like, yes, I do agree that they don't necessarily have all the power. Mm-hmm. However, you're the captain of that ship. And if you don't want, a mutiny, you got to kind of meet them halfway. And if they're the kind of players that just want to show up and play, maybe you don't do a campaign. You know what I mean? Are you doing a long-term campaign because that's what you want? Is it something that they really want, but they're not doing the work? I mean, that's tough. You got to deal with that. But maybe you could play these same characters over the course of modules, right? Like, moving through modules that have shorter times that you have to remember certain details, but you still get the process of improving and leveling up your character. Character advancement is still part of it. I think, you can kind of go that way. If not, then you got to do what Troy says, which is, and I do this plenty in Delta Green, like, this is the person that first talked to you at the blah, blah, blah. You read this name in the city registrar's office on the back of a blueprint of the building. You know what I mean? Like, Nick Lowe in Legacy of the Ancients is uncanny with his note taking. He's unbelievable. He has fun doing that.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things that gets him geeked up is scrolling back and being like, wait. This person was mentioned to us at blah, blah, blah. And then he always gets bottle caps for it because it's great work, you know, and he has fun doing it. I don't have fun doing that. I just like to show up and play. So I get both sides for sure.
Yeah. And sometimes you realize as a player that this might not be the game for you because it's not fair. There was a certain point towards the end of season one of Legacy when I was playing Rhapsody Kincaid where I had no idea who the enemy was we were fighting. And like people kept talking about something. And I was like, I think this is one of the reasons why I was like, I think I might want to replace myself on this show with someone who's going to be more engaged than I am because I felt like I was engaged and I was just missing key things. And it was one of those like realizations, like maybe you got to pull yourself out of the game because you're not doing a service to the people around you and the GM who worked so hard. Dude, I can remember back in our Jade Regent pre-Glass Cannon days having a night where I was like, you guys realize how hard I'm working to prepare this? You guys are just like half-assing everything. You have no idea what's going on. You're not prepared. Yeah, and I'm like, okay, now we can move on with playing. I just needed to say that. It's not like anything really changed, but sometimes you just have to like have that outburst. It's hard. As a GM, you feel like you're constantly like working your ass off to create this great stuff. And it's one thing if you don't get reactions because when you do your little GM scene, but it's another thing when you're like, how do they not know who this fucking guy is? We've been talking about him for weeks. You know, but you can't get mad. You can't get too mad about it. And if it's just one player who's like, always the one that's like, who? You gotta decide for yourself. Does it bother you enough that you want to address it or do you want to move on? And addressing it could be, you know, getting rid of that player or sitting down and being like, hey man, how do you, I feel like you're not really paying attention. And they might be like, no, I am. I'm really enjoying the game. I just hate taking notes.
Yeah. I think that might be it too. The key there is you don't necessarily need to say, what's going on with you, man? Blah, blah. You know, even though that's what you're thinking, 100%. What you need to say is like, what do you enjoy about this game? Like, why do you want to play? And that's the only question you need to ask. And when they lay out what they like and what they want to do, then it's clear. You got to do more of that, less of the other stuff. If you got players that don't care that much about all the details, do less work.
Yeah.
You know, handhold them, railroad them in certain places. Who cares? Because if they're not going to do the work, you don't have to do all the work. You know, it's kind of an interesting balance. But I do like the idea of, you know, shorter form adventures with the same characters. You know, the heroes who move from town to town doing these different missions, PFS style, can rid you of some of that need for remembering long-term details. But anyway, Andrew, thank you for the question. We get it. We certainly get it. Yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of GMs out there that do. But players going to play, man. Players going to play. It is what it is. All right, that's going to do it. That's going to do it for us this week. Let's get on out of here and, I don't know, get back to work. We actually have multiple things that we're working on.
I'm actually doing some reading right now.
Exactly, this week that we can't talk about. Oh,
reading.
What if you're watching the video? Oh, you might see some deets.
Holy,
all right, guys, big week this week. Behind the scenes, we'll have more details, hopefully, for you very soon on Fodder. Until then, have a good one, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks for listening to the Glass Cannon Network. For more podcasts and live streams, visit glasscannonnetwork.com. And for exclusive shows and content you can't find anywhere else, subscribe today at jointhenaish.com.